So this chapter that we're reading from is Opulence of the Absolute. And on text 29, it's very short. So that's why I wanted to sing very long. You're done, maybe. So let's see if I can hit. Anantaschasmani naganam varuno. Oh, I'll sing it once through it. Sorry, because I'm really bad. Excuse me. Varuno yadusamaham pritinam aryanam chasmi yaman yamaha samyaman yamatam aham. Excuse me. Okay, so let's do line by line. Anantaschasmi naganam. Varuno yadasamaham pirtinam aryama jasmi pitrinam, excuse me, yamaha samyamantaham anantas jasmi naganam varuno yadasamaham Pitrinam aryam machasmi Yamaha samyamantaham Anantaschasmi naganam Varuno yadasamaham Pitrinam aryanam chasmi aryama Yamaha samyamantaham yamantaham. Which one? The Yamaha? Yama. Yama. Yeah, it's throwing me off, thanks. Anantaschasmi naganam Varuno yadasamaham Pritrinamaya machasmi Yamasam yamatamaham Anantaschasmi naganam Varuno yasamaham Pritriyamaya machasmi Yamasam yamatamaham. Okay. Ananta. Ananta. Cha. Also. Asmi. I am. Naganam. Of the many hooded serpents. Varuna. The demigod controlling the water. Yadasam. Of all aquatics. Aham. I am. Pritrinam. Of the ancestors. Aryama, Aryama, Cha, also, Asmi, I am, Yama, the controller of death, Samyamatam, Samyamatam, of all regulators, Aham, I am. Of the many hooded Nagas, I am Ananta, and among the aquatics, I am the demigod Varuna. Of departed ancestors, I am Aryama, and among the dispensers of law, I am Yama, the lord of death. Purport. Among the many hooded Naga serpents, Ananta is the greatest, and as the demigod Varuna among the and is the demigod Varuna among the aquatics. They both represent Krishna. There is also a planet of Pitas, ancestors, presided over by Aryama, who represents Krishna. There are many living entities who give punishment to the miscreants, and among them, Yama is the chief. Yama is situated in a planet near this earthly planet. After death, those who are very sinful are taken there, and Yama arranges different kinds of punishments for them. So, Bhagavad Gita's falling apart. It's kind of embarrassing to give class in front of people who know more than you, but what to do? 3. people. So we've been going through this chapter now for a few days, probably because I haven't been here, because they all have short purports. So, I was going to summarize it, but I realized I wasn't here, so it's not fair to summarize, because someone else could have already summarized. But I'll just give a short synopsis. So Arjuna is asking Krishna again, like, tell me about yourself. I want to know more. How is it that you are God and my best friend? And he says, okay, I'll tell you some more, but at the end, actually, it doesn't really matter because I'm inconceivable. So, you know, it's not a lost cause, but I'll give you some things to meditate on, basically. Here are some ways to see me every day. Actually, that's what Arjuna is saying. Can you tell me more ways that I can constantly think of you? So then Krishna goes over millions of the ways. Well, he lists, he says, just the most prominent. And even that, I'm sure it's a very, very shortened down list of the most prominent of all things, basically. So, and then again, he tells Arjuna, the demigods don't even know me in full, nor the great sages. I mean, I'm so inconceivable. But he says, which is really sweet, he says, one who's in faith or is convinced of any of these the opulences that I have, or mystic powers, which is hard for me sometimes to understand Krishna using the word mystic power, because then it sounds like not God. It sounds like some magic or something. But that's the translation of if someone has faith in his opulences and his mystic power, then it's in an equation. If you believe in this, then you will do devotional service, which is really, really nice, because he's pointing out that people who are doing devotional service already have come to this point, not necessarily fully, and maybe not necessarily in this life, but they've already come to this simple point that I am all these things that I'll mention to you and further. So, one of the points, obviously, that comes up in this chapter, but it's generally being woven again and again throughout the Bhagavad Gita, is that Krishna is so kind and merciful to oh no, so sweet. Thanks. He's wearing little apples. These are little apples. So cute. I don't see any bite marks, though. So Krishna is so kind to take form and use his energy, I mean, basically using his time and his energy to be so present in this world and in the cosmic manifestation in all these ways that he mentions to us, of the sun, of the lights, I'm the sun, of the stars, I am the moon, all these things. I mean, he takes the energy out of himself, of himself to be present everywhere so we can't forget him. And then tells Arjuna, actually, I'm doing this for this reason. So it's perfectly set up for us to find him some way or the other. And another point I found interesting, I'm finishing the Krishna book soon, kind of fully reading it, you know. I mean, I know some of the stories, but reading it, and there's so much actually deep philosophy within it. And one of the things Prabhupada says, he kind of sneaks things in, so you have to really look for it. He says that actually one of the reasons that the material world was made by Krishna is because we had the desires, but we couldn't have made it ourselves. And we had all these desires. I mean, it's an understood fact that we have these desires. We want to do. We wanted to be here. We wanted to be doing what we're doing. But like a child wants to do some kind of nonsense, but the child is not even able to do it himself, not even able to create the little toy house that he wants to break. He's not able to do it. So Krishna created the material world for us because we couldn't do it. Of course, because we wanted it, but it's just we're not even capable. It's very humbling to think that we're not only really selfish and petty to be wanting such material, I'm just really temporary things, but also that Krishna doesn't even mind to do it for us because we're so feeble and weak that we couldn't do it ourselves. It's really, it's a nice thought. So, so for example, the way that he's so kind, he comes as this Aryama. I mean, this is a planet for people who worship ancestors and people, I mean, it's nice, it's very, very common. Where I'm from, it's very, it's kind of what people do. Hawaiians, they worship ancestors. The Chinese worship ancestors. The Japanese worship ancestors. They have a very nice culture of this, and it has its benefits that it brings respect to the elders, I mean, obviously, and the family line, and, you know, but you're very much tied to family, the family, completely indebted to the family. And it's a Vedic system. So, in any way, he makes sure that he's present even there. And he says he's a presider of this planet. So that even if someone happens to be worshipping their forefathers, which many people do, he's there. And they're getting connected to him somehow, even through that. I mean, of course, there are other ways they're getting connected, but that's one of the ways he makes himself present. So I find, again, that's just ways that Krishna is so nice to us. Unnecessarily nice to us, I feel like. Yeah. So two of the he makes a point that he's Ananta Shesh, and then he's Aryama, and then Yama. So the Nagas, I love the Nagas. I wish we could have a movie just about them. They're just like so cool. And me and Vishnu just love the Nagas. And I just finished the Mahabharata, and of course there's a lot of stories of them in there. But there's some controversy I'll get to. But first, so Ananta Shesh, I found in the... This is interesting. This is why I'm happy I have people here who know more than me. So you can answer my question. But, so I'm just looking, trying to look a little bit further into Ananta Shesh and who, I mean, a little bit about him. Oh no, database open. Oh no. Gosh. Yeah, it's very... Yes, exactly. And I found a very interesting quote in Vedabase about this. I'm sure you've seen it because you live on Vedabase. But Vishnu's new computer is not working for me for some reason. This is his new computer. Okay, here it is. So I found this from other books by Srila Prabhupada in the Vedabase because I looked through the Bhagavad Gita and I looked through a few of them and I found nothing new. I mean, not new, but, you know, just something a little interesting. So then I found this in the... Mukunda Mala Stotra. Now, I don't know exactly what that is about, but he speaks about Ananta Shesh here. And he's what you're talking about. It's a little confusing. So he says, Srila Prabhupada says, in the purport to this one of these sections, I didn't go so far up because it gets very complex, so I just kept to the basics. So he says that the Lord of the creative energy is called Ananta Shayana, with the S with the accent over Shayana. The material energy is impregnated by the glance of this feature of the Lord and is then able to give birth to all organic and inorganic matter. Ananta Shayana sleeps on the bed of Shesha Naga. So now he's calling Shesha Naga. I mean... Okay, so who has a form like a serpent, but is identical with the Lord. So now he's saying Sheshanaga is non-different than Vishnu. Because when we understand Mahavishnu and Ananta Shesha, we see them as two, I mean we understand, but two separate. But here it's saying something a little different. And he says, because he sleeps on a serpent bed, the Lord is also known as Naga Shayana. He is... By his spiritual energy, Sheshanaga sustains all the planetary globes upon his invisible hoods. Sheshanaga is popularly known as Sankarshan. So this is what he's saying. I mean, for me, Sankarshan is Balaram. I mean, that's how I've understood things. Maybe I'm very wrong with that. Balaram, of course. Of course, it's some other level. Yeah. Of course, Krishna is confusing. Or that, so Sankarshana means, or that which keeps balanced by the law of magnetism. So then he's going into the idea that Sankarshana is, he's going to say, is the law of gravity as well. I mean, it's really like all over. So in the scientific world, this feature of the Lord is referred to as the law of gravitation. But factually, this law, which keeps all the planets floating in space, is one of the energies of the Lord. All the universes are born with the exhaling of the Lord as he lies floating in space as one of the energies of the Lord. I'm sorry, which... unstationaga. And all of them are annihilated with his inhalation. Due to these functions of creation, maintenance, and annihilation, the Lord is celebrated by the name Jagannivesha, indicating that he's the supreme resort of all the universes. So he's saying that, so Seshanaga is Sankarshan, but, and Seshanaga, I mean, Ananta Shayan is his energy, which is on, lays on Ananta Seshanaga, and then you call him Ananta Shesh. I mean, I've never heard the word Ananta Shayan and Seshanaga and all the terms. Yeah, I under. I think so too, and that's what he's going to. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, it's Maha, Mahavishnu. It's Maha, Mahuan, Maha. That's he's saying here. Yeah, and that's what he's meaning. Me neither. The universe one? No, okay, no. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I think that... Exactly. Different places, and maybe it's also kind of like a title, Sankarshan, because this says that that which keeps the balance of the law of magnetism. Yeah, exactly. It's a little too mind-blowing. So, Ananta Shesh is... Krishna says, I am Ananta Shesh, and I believe him in all of his expansions. So, then... So, I'm just speaking about the Nagas. Often, Nagas are referred to... You just think of a snake. I mean, they're snakes. But then, within our own... scripture, we have Nagas and serpents. And even in some same purports, you will find a serpent or and then a Naga. So now I'm trying to think, okay, what does it mean? And then I was thinking that maybe it's more close to these, like we have Yakshas and Gandharvas and Nagas. We have our own, it's like a clan. It's like a type of person or type of person kind of animal mixed. So then I was looking into it and I found, on the web there's, in India there's a tribe of people that still consider themselves Nagas. And then there's Naga Babas and all these things. I mean, that doesn't surprise me, especially like Babajis who are Naga Babajis. Actually, they call those the naked ones specifically. One of them, yeah. And that's a different form, different use of the word. But in India, there's a, they claim to be Naga descendants, and they're in like northeast India and Burma that claim to be Naga descendants. But they're a little strange. I mean, they're not a little, they're quite strange. And they still practice, well, they would still be practicing headhunting, I mean, chopping people's heads off and like using them to shoot on display. But I think, I mean, in the 19th century it said they stopped probably because they would get, I don't know, put in jail or something. So I don't know exactly if they refer to which, I mean, what Nagas do they refer to? Because all of my understanding of Nagas is mostly from the Mahabharata. And they were definitely water people. I mean, they definitely attacked people, but to think that they were headhunters is a little far off. But it was interesting just to see that even in modern India, they have these still around. And of course, we're going to Thailand, and I've been looking a lot into Thailand. And it's very Buddhist country, like completely Buddhist country. And you find statues of Buddha with the Anantashesh over. Yeah, it's really cool. I mean, it's Buddha. It's exciting to see all the... I mean, because Buddhism has been complete, it started as one and it's really spread into all kinds of varieties. So I'm interested to see what's really going on in Thailand with Buddhism. But they have, for example, they have the huge, huge golden Buddha laying. You've seen the pictures? I mean, it's huge, probably as big as this room, golden Buddha, in near Bangkok. We're going to go see it. And all these, I mean, they have many, many, many nice temples. And I want to find the one with the Shesha coming over him. So what else about the Nagas? So the Nagas are usually are quite controversial because, I mean, in like for in the Mahabharata, they're understood to be quite snake-like. I mean, in a negative sense of the snake. When you think of a snake, you think of envious. You think of, I mean, Prabhupada says there's, you can kill envious creatures. The snake is envious. And then the Nagas are... So they're quite controversial because they're kind of perceived in this way, yet they don't really do anything bad, any worse than any of the other kinds of people, I guess, creatures in the story. But they're still kind of perceived as kind of snake-like. They probably no one knows what I'm talking about, but there's in the newest Pirates of the Caribbean movie... They have mermaids. And I always think of mermaids as Nagas. Those are my connection. And I imagine because, I mean, Arjuna married a Naga princess. So to me, she's a mermaid. I'm convinced. But in this movie, the mermaids were evil. And I was thinking, this is probably more close to the Nagas. I mean, not evil, evil. I mean, one of them wasn't evil, for example. But they killed, you know, and they were like vicious. And they were like... Yeah, they had advantage because they could swim in the water and they could just take people out, kind of thing. So it's kind of the conception of Nagas generally in the Mahabharata, from my understanding. But yeah, Arjuna was... What is the story of Arjuna? I forget how he ends up in the water. He's dying. How does he end up in the water? Do you remember when the Nagas king saves him? Maybe. Was this at the lake... Because I know the lake where everyone died. I mean, gosh, crazy story. But I can't remember if it was this or another. Because then he ends up with another wife. And I was like, how does that happen? Because the king saved him and then he gave him his daughter. Uksha. No, or with a U. I tried to find it in Veda because I couldn't find the Mahabharata to find my exact thing. Yeah, and in Krishna Dharma's, I mean, his book is great, but it's you know, the Mahabharata is huge. So we just go into little pieces. I mean, I really like it, so that's why I want a bigger version of it. So anyways, the Nagas, there's lots of information about them, but it's a little, like I'm saying, controversial, and I'm not sure exactly how to pinpoint their personality. So, but Krishna is Anantashesh, which is always understood as positive. I mean, Anantashesh isn't ever seen as a negative. I mean, Kaliya is seen as negative. Of course, his wives are like, why are you, what are you doing to our husband? You know, confused why Krishna's playing with her husband. So it's a little like there's confusion. The Nagas don't think they're bad, and everyone else thinks they're bad, and maybe they're not bad. So, and yeah. So then that's one of them, the Nagas, and then he says he's Yamaraj. So Yamaraj is interesting. There's two stories that I like about Yamaraj. One is the story of Savitri. Does everyone know? I like this one. That's why I'm going to name my daughter Savitri. So the story of Savitri is actually really cool. I used it in one of my papers in the college because to show kind of a different personality of women, because often, I mean, women have a few roles. But if you really look, you find some have done amazing things. For example, Queen Kunti, of course, but also Savitri. So Savitri is a princess, and I mean, really beautiful and everything. And nobody wants to marry her because she's too beautiful and smart and things. So because it's really what it says. I was like, oh, poor lady. So we know some ladies here. I mean, we know some of our teachers, for example, they have problems for these reasons. So. Sorry, just coming to my mind. So I think the reason her dad had made a boon, I mean, had wished for her, and she had come, not from fire, but she had come some mystical way, so she was like, you know, special. So then she's trying to get married, nobody wants to marry her, and dad's like, okay, you know, go with a minister or someone and go find your husband. First of all, interesting point that he allowed her to go find her husband. So she did. Then she went to the forest and found this, you know, beautiful Brahmin, aesthetic man. Wow, I can't remember her husband's name. Anyways, so, and she says, let's get married. They're going to get married. So they're married for a bit, and she's warned he's going to die quite early in their marriage. And she says, it's okay, I still want to marry him. So she marries him, and then Yamaraj comes while they're one day out, and takes, and you know, comes in front of them and starts taking him down to hell. And she's like, what are you doing? You can't take my husband. And she follows him. He follows him all the way to hell and tricks him in the end. I mean, in a sense, not a bad trick, but kind of, you know, intelligently tricks him into getting her husband back, bringing her father's, like, I think her father became blind or something, or his father. I mean, she made like three boons out of it. I mean, somehow, to Yamaraj. She tricked him into her father-in-law's kingdom had been lost, to get back the kingdom, for her husband to come back to life, and something else. So she went down to hell and convinced Yamaraj of this. Actually, she was just following him. I mean, I can't even imagine. He was walking and she was following him. I mean, obviously, she was a special lady. She could see Yamaraj and stop him. But so that's one story of Yamaraj. So it's a kind of a new light on his personality and how he... I mean, in the picture book, of course, he's quite ugly, kind of like a demon looking, but I never would picture Yamaraj as a demon. I'd see him as, you know, like he's a working guy. He's sitting all day, you know, like a judge or something. So she even tricked him. Which is funny. Of course, it probably has a bigger plan. The story didn't go into it so far into it. So that's one story that I like in regards to Yamaraj. And also, of course, Yudhisthira. So Yudhisthira is Yamaraj's son. And then Yudhisthira has to go to Yamaraj himself at the end. So, I mean, it's so... Ugh. I can imagine if this was a movie, the Mahabharata, I would just be crying and crying. I mean, I was crying reading it. And they're going up the hill. And up and up. What is the top of the mountain they're going to? Kailash. No. They're trying to go to, I guess, heaven. I still don't know. They call it, what is the term used in the book? Swargalok. Which is, I mean, for me, a very Hindu word when I think of it, because it's not something we ever refer to. We don't say, hey, we're going to Swargalok. And then it's in the Mahabharata. But I've understood it's heaven, and I still don't understand why they were trying to go to heaven. But so yeah, they're all going up and everybody's falling, you know. First Draupadi, because she was too attached to Arjuna. Then this, you know, and everyone's attached. And then I thought, Yudhisthira would fall because he's attached to this dog who's chasing him, who's following him. Then he gets to the top, and of course the dog is Yamaraj. And then Yamaraj is like, you're the only one who would do the right thing and bring, you know, bring such a helpless animal all the way to the top and all these things. So it was like a test. He passed. But then he had to go to Yamaraj because of what? Do you remember why he had to go? Ashvatam. Yeah, the... And softly he's, yep. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. He was invincible. I mean, all of them. It's amazing. They're all so invincible. I still don't understand. They always say, like, he's the best. No, he's the best. And I still can't understand who's the best, because everyone's the best. And to me, Arjuna's supposed to be the best, because he's the hero, you know? But then he says he can't even kill his own grandfather. I mean, Bhishma, you know, had to give up. Yeah, Bhishma was... I mean, he's also the oldest. You know, he's coming from, like, another yuga. Yeah, also, so he had a lot of power. Very true. But, I mean, he had a woman chasing him to kill him, so I don't know if his brahmachari years worked out so well. And he did some offenses as a brahmachari. But anyway, So Yudhisthira has this kind of... And Yudhisthira is a difficult character for me, because he always does what's right, even when everyone... I mean, Krishna's like, yeah, forget it. And Yudhisthira's like, no, I must continue. I mean, he's not my favorite character. Of course, as a pure devotee, it's all rasa in this thing, so I'm not there yet, but at least he's not my favorite character, usually for that reason, because he's always doing what's right. So for this case, he thought, no, I can't lie, like you're saying. But actually, he went to Yamaraj because he didn't follow Krishna's orders, because Krishna told him, I am in control. You know that. You're always glorifying me, yet when I ask you to do something, you don't do what I've said. I mean, do you not trust me? You know, and Arjuna would always, I mean, sometimes very hesitantly, but would always follow. And that's why Arjuna was Krishna's best friend, of course, for other reasons as well. But so he had to go see Yamaraj because of this. And sometimes it may be, it's always, Krishna's always doing things I find, it's like a paradox. So you would think he would have to go to Yamaraj because he lied, you know, and that in turn killed Dronacharya, but of course not. He had to go because Krishna's in control. It's really a difficult... I mean, the Mahabharata is an amazing story, and I find I actually like it for preaching purposes, because it can connect to so many people, especially Hindus, which I find we have a hard time to persuade them. I mean, to really give them something they think they don't already have. So, I mean, that's why I just read Mahabharata and the Ramayana. I want to get a little further into our tradition so we can kind of help those who already, you know things about it. So, but in this point alone is like a perfect preaching point for Hindus and others who have some cultural background with the Mahabharata in our text. And anyway, so those are two stories that I think about when I think of Yamaraj, because he's always referred to, but not necessarily, for me, given a face. He's not someone that we glorify, yet him and Maya kind of do all of the dirty work. I mean, they do it all, and we don't glorify them, which, I mean, there's many reasons, I'm sure, but sometimes I just like to think about, I mean, you see the people around the temple who do all of the dirty work. It's kind of a similar task sometimes. The guys who break all the boxes down and go through the trash and stuff, and they're kind of like that. But Krishna says he is Yamaraj. He's the ultimate decider. But we can see from Savitri's story, for example, Yamaraj isn't like set in stone about everything, because you can convince him otherwise. And a point that comes out from this is that that, again, of course, Krishna makes himself available to everyone, because as we know, if you never, I mean, one of the things that I always thought was puzzling when I was a child is Christians say that if you don't, you know, repent to Jesus, you don't know Jesus and become baptized, then you'll go to hell. And of course you think, okay, but what about people who don't know Jesus? Which, I mean, the world is getting much smaller because of communication and things. But there are still people on this planet who don't know who Jesus is. And I always thought, how does that exist? And then I would think of our tradition and think about, what about us? If you don't know Krishna, does that mean you go to hell? I mean, what does it mean? So, of course, for us, it's not the case. I mean, Krishna makes himself available in every form, in every possible way. And, of course, even as Yamaraj, that if you don't see him in life, you will definitely see him at death. And there's mercy attached. I mean, there's he's so merciful. Even then, he shows himself to even the worst sinners, of course. So, to conclude, Prabhupada says some really funny things sometimes. I think. If he wasn't so serious, he could be a comedian. I mean, he says some really, he makes fun of people and doesn't even think twice about it. So he says that those who know these things about the Lord, you know, the opulence is, I was saying the opulence is his mystic powers, are called a brahmana. And of course that goes into, I mean, for us it's important to look at the terminology. Sometimes we and Indians call brahmanas as a caste still, but for Prabhupada, he says that Krishna says those who know Krishna is a brahmin, are brahmins, and those who don't are called kripanas or kripana. Do you know the word? Which means he says number one miser, number one, and it's really funny to think that. That, okay, a brahmana, obviously we can understand what that is. It has its own context. But a number one miser, I mean, a miser is somebody who, like, hoards and keeps to himself and doesn't share and is, like, you know, selfish, basically. Selfish and lonely. And misers are just usually grouchy, I mean, like the Grinch or somebody like that is a miser. And so Prabhupada said those who don't know Krishna in these forms is like that, and it makes perfect sense. I mean, you can see this in your head. People who are so closed off and cold, they are not able to see Krishna, and they become very miserly because of that. So, who's to say if the Naga people really exist still? I don't know, but Krishna says an easy way to remember him is that everything beautiful and glorious is him, and it's only just a spark of his splendor. Any questions? Sorry, Rand. I thought it'd be too short. Questions, comments? She came out of there. Yeah, I don't have the answers is the problem. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Saving my life.